Let's take a moment now to meet a man who describes himself as a serial entrepreneur. Jonathan Kaplan started his first businesses when he was a kid with a paper route, snow shoveling, then landscaping. He's had a printing company and a DJ service playing sweet 16 parties and bar mitzvahs, and that is all before Kaplan hit college. If anything, he's picked up speed since then, founding several tech companies, including the one that brought you the Flip digital camera. He sold that to Cisco for more than $500 million. Kaplan joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco to talk about his next venture. Jonathan Kaplan, good morning.
Good morning.
So your current project is setting up a chain of grilled cheese restaurants. Why grilled cheese?
Well, it's a really simple answer to that question, and that is grilled cheese makes people happy. And when I created the Flip, I wanted to really think about a way to change the way people captured and shared video, a way for consumers to feel empowered and make memories. And, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia, there's a lot of memories, and there's a lot of happiness in the very simple grilled cheese and soup.
You actually went out to Mall of America, is that right? And talked to people about what kind of food makes them happy.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Grilled cheese is one of these food items that people talk about with emotional connection. You know, when you're sitting with a friend and you say, what do you think of a salad? They're like, oh, salads are okay. But if you say, what do you think of a grilled cheese? They say, I love grilled cheese. I mean, and they conjures up memories and nostalgia. And the words that I was hearing were just so exceptional. I mean, it reminded me so much of chocolate or, you know, some other things that maybe we won't mention on the air. But it's really
comfort food.
You know, comfort food. It's a real comfort food. So I did go to the Mall of America about 10 years ago, and I wanted to test this with everyday Americans. And the reaction was pretty much the same. People love grilled cheese.
You went out to Mall of America 10 years ago. Does that mean this is an idea you've had in your back pocket all this time, just waiting for the right moment?
You know, one of the things that's interesting about entrepreneurs is they tend to have a lot of ideas all the time. And 10 years ago, I was thinking about what should I be doing next? And Flip hadn't started yet. And I just finished my last business and sold it to Sega of Japan. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I thought, hey, maybe I'll do a grilled cheese and soup chain. We'll call it something. I don't even know what we'll call it. And so I went to the Mall of America and did some research. And just as I was doing some research, I realized, you know, there's something else I really want to do first. And that's when Flip started, and now it's time to do the melt.
All right. So will you tell us what's in your back pocket right now that 10 years from now we'll be talking to you about?
I can't wait to come back on the air and tell you.
All right. Jonathan Kaplan, as we said, you have started a lot of businesses over the years. Maybe the highest profile up to now was the Flip camera, which eventually did sell to Cisco. They shut it down. What did you learn from that?
Well, I learned that anything is possible. When I started out, we wanted to democratize video. This was a pretty tall order to do when you had the likes of the Sonys and the Panasonics and the Canons. And, you know, you have a group of young entrepreneurs that didn't really know much about video at all. But I knew that we were onto something. We ended up selling more than 7 million units and really, I think, changing video for the better. And I'm very proud of what the team created.
Were you disappointed when it was shut down?
Well, of course, I was disappointed when it was shut down. It was very, very disappointing. But I'm also a business person, and I understand why Cisco has to make business decisions. And they're still using our technology for many things that are happening at Cisco. But if you look at that business and the idea that we were only a billion of the $45 billion in revenue that that company generates every year, you know, I have to respect their decision. But I'm really excited about the melt.
As you gear up for this new venture, have you found it hard to start a new company in the current business climate? I mean, what advice do you have for other people out there who have an idea and might have a harder time than you have had trying to get the money to get it going?
Well, I think that, you know, right now the economy is in a place where great ideas are going to get funded. There are some times in our economy in 2001, as an example, and maybe a year ago, where it was very hard to get any idea funded. But I think right now we're coming out of our recession, and I feel like great ideas will be funded. The advice that I would have for entrepreneurs is very simple, which is stick to your idea, stay focused, hire great people, and be sure that you're as passionate about your idea as you're telling everybody you are. Because if you are, if you're willing to eat hot dogs, if you're willing to take no salary, if you're willing to hear no so many times that it sounds like yes, then you'll probably be successful.
Jonathan Kaplan, thanks very much.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Oh, we've been talking with Jonathan Kaplan. His latest business is a chain of grilled cheese restaurants called The Melt. They open next month.
The title and poster for the new film Cowboys and Aliens have been getting people excited for nearly a year, and it's finally here. Directed by Jon Favreau of Iron Man and starring Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford. There's another alien invasion movie opening today called Attack the Block, which is a low-budget film from Britain. Film critic David Edelstein reviews them both.
The sci-fi western Cowboys and Aliens has something for everyone, and not enough for anyone. I couldn't help thinking of the missed opportunities to play with two such disparate American genres. That said, Jon Favreau is a crafty director. He adds suspense to a bland story by withholding all the pertinent details, keeping us in a happy state of anticipation. It starts with a start. Rugged, blue-eyed Daniel Craig wakes up in the desert with a wound in his side, a metallic bracelet on his wrist, and no memory, though he does have super fighting skills. He's haunted, but by what? He walks through the swinging door of a saloon in a failed gold mining town and drinks to ease the pain. But being a Western hero, he's soon punching out rich bully Paul Dano, who's beating up mousy saloon keeper Sam Rockwell. Then Dano's daddy, a baleful Harrison Ford, shows up with his men, and it looks like they'll be shooting until... what the heck? The camera makes like Spielberg's, tracking in on characters gazing at a glow on the horizon that turns out to be little ships that whiz in and snatch up screaming earthlings. No spoilers, folks. But nothing brings folks together like aliens. The outlaw, the greedy capitalist boss, and even the Native American chief are now on the same side. Too bad those aliens are a massive disappointment. Their ships clearly computer-generated and too fast to generate much awe. The CGI ETs, apart from one Nazi-like surgeon, anonymous. The cowboys get the screen time, sometimes too much. Rumor has it Ford insists on having his parts beefed up, so even with a supporting role, he has draggy scenes in which he gruffly bonds with the sheriff's grandson and acts racist toward his Native American top man, Adam Beach. Gorgeous, cat-eyed Olivia Wilde stands around as a woman who, what on earth is she doing? In Cowboys and Aliens, not knowing is more fun than finding out. The low-budget British film Attack the Block has what's missing from Cowboys and Aliens. It's wall-to-wall sci-fi pop culture bric-a-brac, yet feels homegrown. The gang of hooligans, mostly black, live in a South London project and mug a white nurse played by Jodie Whittaker. So it's neighbor against neighbor. Until the creatures plummet to earth. One kid describes them as looking like a monkey crossed with a fish, and they have iridescent fangs that rip people to shreds. Dig these great accents as the teens decide how to take on the invaders.
What is that, cuz?
That's an alien, bruv, believe it. And I landed in the wrong place, though. You get the wrong place.
As leader of the gang, John Boyega has the poise of Denzel Washington and a gift for playing three things at once: pride, courage, and fear. He can't be shown up, which is why he chases down the first little alien that lands, kills it, and carries it on a stick like a trophy. It's only later he understands his macho instinct for revenge has indirectly caused much of the carnage. But not all. These are nasty creatures, and there's tons of splatter. But ultimately, this is the story of kids on their own, with no authority figures who believe their story. One kid even wonders if the creatures weren't sent to kill black boys because, quote, we ain't killing each other fast enough. To defend the block, they grab ninja swords, guns, and fireworks, and teaming up now with Jodie Whittaker's nurse, prove they're made of nobler stuff. Attack the Block was written and directed by Joe Cornish, and the executive producer was Edgar Wright, who made Shaun of the Dead. Cornish, like Wright, uses genre parody and homage not to deflate his material, but rethink and revitalize it. Unlike the colossally budgeted Cowboys and Aliens, you don't come out of this one thinking, I wonder how much that cost.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Okay, let's look at what will happen if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling and the U.S. Treasury has to decide which bills to ignore and which to pay. NPR's Zoe Chase of our Planet Money team says interest on bonds will likely come first.
You don't even have to think twice about what to pay first. It's not even really a choice.
First of all, interest payments will always be made first, and there's really no thought process there. It just has to be that way.
Former Undersecretary of the Treasury Jerome Powell says interest on government bonds comes first, even if you skip something like food stamps. Why?
The answer to that question is that if we start defaulting on our debt, there are going to be a whole lot more people on food stamps than there are now.
All right, let's break this down. Bonds are IOUs the U.S. government sells in order to finance itself. The government sells bonds to basically everybody, to pension funds, to companies, to households. It turns out that over and over in a fiscal crisis, interest on bond payments gets VIP treatment. For example, I sat down with two of the white knights that pulled New York City out of bankruptcy in 1975.
I remember Manhattan Community College downtown was half built, and I gave the order to stop. Send all the construction workers home, board it up. We will finish it after the fiscal crisis.
That's Donald Cummerfield, former budget director of New York City. And sitting across from him is Richard Ravitch, who worked in the governor's office then.
When did you guys meet and become friends?
1976.
In 1975, the city defaulted on some of its payments. In order to continue to do business, they had to cut deep. But they still put interest payments on bonds first, even in front of sanitation workers, which upset the sanitation workers' union.
They let the garbage pile up on the streets of New York when they were on strike. Eventually, we settled it, and they came back and picked it up. But the city was pretty stinking.
Richard Ravitch says they wanted to defer the interest payments on the city's loans, and it went all the way to the highest court in the state.
We did pass a law deferring the payment of interest on debts, but the court ultimately said that that law was unconstitutional, that the state had to use its inherent taxing power to meet its obligations.
Payment on bonds came first in 1975, and again 4 weeks ago in Minnesota. Here's Cummerfield.
State of Minnesota is a good example. Recently, they ran out of money. But before they did that, they passed a law saying the first revenues that the state of Minnesota has will be to pay debt service on our bonds. And after that, we will pay, you know, go down the line, we close parks, we close this.
Why do we make interest on bonds the top priority, the first payment? Ask a former Treasury official, and he'll say,
Treasury bills are the only financial instrument in the world where anyone can invest in them and believe that there's literally no risk of not being paid back.
Ask a buyer of U.S. debt. He'll agree. Mark Peterson is treasurer of ServiceMaster, based in Memphis, Tennessee. They do lawn care. He uses treasuries to pay his employees.
Like in our True Green lawn business, the season is the summer. So in the middle of June and July, we're applying a lot more applications of our fertilizers and pesticides on people's lawns. We then bill the customers, and the customers' payments come in later.
No problem. Peterson just taps his investments, U.S. Treasury bonds, and pays his employees with that money. When the payments come in, he reinvests it in U.S. Treasury bonds, the safest investment in the world. If you don't pay back your creditors, you're no longer the safest investment in the world. The government knows this. People like Peterson may stop lending to you. They'll buy other bonds that look safer, and it will become harder to borrow money. That's why paying the interest on your bonds is the number one priority of a city in a hole of debt, a state in a hole of debt, and a country in a hole of debt. Zoe Chase, NPR News, New York.
The North Slope of Alaska is not a place that sees a lot of wildfires. It's tundra up there, cold and wet and covered in moss, grass, and low scrub. But in 2007, an extraordinary fire broke out at a place called Anaktuvik. It burned for 4 months. It was the biggest fire in the region since records started in the 1950s. And now scientists say they discovered something disturbing about that fire. How much carbon it released into the atmosphere. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on what may be a new trend in the Arctic.
It's peak field season right now for scientists who study the Arctic, like Michelle Mack.
I'm at Tulik Lake Field Station in a trailer that's on a gravel pad that's in the middle of Arctic tundra.
Mack is an ecologist from the University of Florida who prefers the desolate beauty of the North Slope of Alaska and the snow-capped Brooks Mountain Range. She says what the Anaktuvik fire did, burn through 400 square miles of tundra, amazed her.
We've never seen anything like it in this area. What's surprising is that forests have huge trees, whereas tundra has 6-inch tall, tiny little plants.
Nonetheless, the fire sizzled for 3 months, then burst into a major conflagration before snowfall put it out. So if there weren't any trees, what was there to burn?
It's coming from the soil.
Organic matter, dead plants, accumulated over decades. And what set it off was dry weather and then a lightning strike.
There's been a marked increase in lightning strike activity on the North Slope, particularly in the last 10 years.
But Mack was really surprised when she calculated how much carbon that fire put up into the atmosphere. It was 2 million tons. Is that a lot? Well, think of it this way. Every year, the Arctic tundra absorbs more carbon from the atmosphere than it releases. It's a net carbon sink. Because carbon warms the atmosphere, the Arctic is actually cooling the planet by taking up carbon. But Mack says the Anaktuvik fire reversed that equation.
One fire, that alone is enough to offset the whole uptake.
That's right. The fire put out more carbon than the entire Arctic tundra absorbed in 2007. That includes Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Russia. Mack's findings are part of an increasingly feverish research effort going on in the Arctic. Arctic sea ice has been melting, putting more moisture in the air and creating more thunderstorms. Geographer Eric Kashishki of the University of Maryland is also in Alaska this week, studying, among other things, why there have been so many fires there recently. Between the region's big forests and the carbon-rich tundra soil, he says there's a lot of carbon that's at risk of getting loose.
So you might see in a single fire event 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 years of carbon released instantaneously. And so I think this is part of a larger story that you're seeing deeper burning fires across the landscape, and together they're really going to change things pretty dramatically.
Besides pumping more carbon into the atmosphere, the Arctic fires also melt the permafrost. That's the permanent layer of frozen soil and water underneath the surface. When that disappears, so does a major source of moisture for the tundra.
It does have cause for concern. We might be seeing really major changes in the way that these ecosystems function in high northern latitudes, and fire might be that trigger.
The research appears in the latest issue of the journal Nature. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
It is Friday morning, which is when we hear from StoryCorps, the project that records family stories across America. From the 40s through the 60s in the last century, the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York were a popular summer escape. The region was known as the Borscht Belt, especially popular among New York City Jews. It boasted more than 500 hotels and resorts that needed to entertain their guests. So, a talent agent named Jack Siegel made his living booking novelty acts there. Recently, his son Mort Siegel and daughter Joan Feldman remembered their dad.
He employed performers that the other agents would never use or couldn't even find, like the Lilliputian stripper, blind xylophone player.
He had dog acts.
He had dog acts.
Sometimes the hotels would complain,
right.
Why are you sending me something like that?
Like that.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
But he felt for every person, there was a show somewhere and somebody would like them.
In the heyday of the Catskills, the performers slept on the pool tables, on the stage, in the chicken coop. And Dad would never have any of that. So he used to say to the hotels, part of your contract has to be you have to give them the room. And when he went up there the first weekend, after he got all the performers situated, he realized that he didn't have a place,
to stay. Right.
So a cop used to stand there to direct the traffic, and Dad went up to him and he said, "I don't have a place to stay. Lock me up."
He always thought that the next performer that he met would make it to the top. Unfortunately, something would always come up where the next step never came about. He had a acrobatic tap dancer out of Florida. It was sensational. The guy developed a knee infection.
And he came to live with us.
Right.
I gave up my room, but this was my parents. My parents always took in the underdog.
There was always an empty chair available at our kitchen table if somebody needed a meal. And I used to tell friends that the best shows were the shows after the shows when they came back to our house.
Yeah. Isn't that where Buddy Hackett took his shower with his clothes on?
Yeah. It was just a fun time.
That's Mort Siegel and Joan Feldman remembering their father, Jack Siegel, at StoryCorps in New York City. Their conversation will be archived along with all StoryCorps interviews at the Library of Congress. And as always, you can find the podcast at npr.org.